your host for today, Jeff Pickle.
Welcome to the Jennifer Campbell Show. Jeff Pickle here, filling in for Jennifer here on Monday morning. Unfortunately, Jen feeling a little bit under the weather today. So doing the smart thing and staying in. Now this is the time when more people are feeling a little bit sick. A lot of bugs going around, and you need to take the lead of people like Jennifer Campbell. When you're sick, stay home. We don't need a hero. Not around these times. If you come in sick, no one's going to think you're a hero. They're going to think you're a jerk for making everyone else sick. And no one wants that. We're already thinned out. We're short numbers all over the place. People dropping like flies because people think they want to come in sick. Don't do it. Stay home. So Jen taking a rest today. Very likely we'll be back at the helm here tomorrow. But for right now, you got me in studio. Now I myself am well rested, refreshed, ready to come back. I had last week off. I was down in the sunny state of Florida, in the Sunshine State. And I got to tell you, it looks a little different than it does here. There's a few more palm trees. The sun seemed a little brighter. It was definitely a little bit warmer. Now, I had a great week of weather. It was unbelievable. I flew down there last Friday, and it was... Now, I was looking at it in Fahrenheit all the time, so I think it was like low 80s every day I was down there. I know. I don't blame you for being a little jealous. So it was low 80s every day I was down there, all 7 days. The last day was the only day it was a little bit cloudy. Then I fly home, and then my brother was actually going down the next day. Him and his family were going down, and the temperature dropped from mid-80s to like high 60s. So I literally, and it's going to stay that way for him the whole time. I mean, still a lot nicer than a couple inches of snow on the ground, but I really felt good that I got to rub it into him that, you know, I always said the sun shines a little brighter on the younger Pickle, and it certainly was the case last week. But we're actually going to be talking a little bit about Florida a little later on, and one of the, I guess you could say, bizarre things that's actually not illegal in Florida. Usually they have some pretty tougher on crime down there in the southern states, but there's one thing that's not illegal in Florida. It is illegal here, definitely illegal here. It's a big fine here, and we're going to talk about that a little later because it was shocking that I found out it is not legal. So we're going to get to that in just about 10 minutes time. But yeah, I wanted to say glad to be back. I am glad to be back at work, but I can't lie to you and say that I'm glad to be back so far north. You just start to get used to a southern climate. You're there. It's something about the sun there. It sucks you in. You start thinking like a Floridian, and then all of a sudden you're back here. James Sebastian Scott joining me in studio. You know, I actually had a plan at one point in time. One point in my life, a plan that I was going to live in Florida for several months of a year. It wasn't like a fully thought out plan, but for one summer, I worked for a company putting up tents, like big like wedding tents and ceremonial tents and that sort of stuff. And we could only obviously do that here in the summer months. And my idea was to pack up the trailer with all this tent material and then drive down to Florida and then do that same tent business in over the winter months and then just drive back here. So I'd be like a snowbird. And that was my idea of how I could be a full-time tent man and live half the time in the Sunshine State.
So in Florida, you'd be a seasonal tent man. And then in Canada, you'd be also a seasonal tent man.
Yeah, I would just follow the tenting season around. I would follow the sun, go to where they needed tents being put up, and do that. That was like one of the thoughts I had on one of the long drives as we were about to put up. I liked the job. It was a fun job. I enjoyed it. I was like, yeah, Maybe that's what I'll do. That was before I got into school for broadcasting and like that. I was thinking, like, maybe I don't need to, you know, maybe I could do something like this.
It's a dangerous job, too, if it's raining.
Yeah.
Lightning or something like that, you know?
Yeah,
you got to be aware of that.
Of overhead wires, yeah. Well, it didn't work out, and I'm here. And I'm happy to be here. Yeah, and I am glad to be here. And, you know, there's one thing that over the weekend caught my eye, James. I was really surprised that you didn't see anything about this because I saw it all over Twitter and some social media accounts of the story. When I saw it was, you may have heard of him, Keaton Jones, a little 10-year-old boy from Knoxville, Tennessee, was being bullied at school. Then he recorded a video with his mother just, you know, kind of asking, you know, why, essentially that question, why do, you know, people bully? And when I saw the picture in the video and I saw a little boy's face there with the tears in his eyes, it's a very good chance if you've been on Facebook or Twitter, you've seen it. I couldn't watch it because I knew it would be something that would be, you know, just gut-wrenching and emotional, that it would, you know, hurt. It would hurt to watch this, you know, young boy who was, you know, being teased and bullied at school. So I put it off. I didn't watch it. But then, you know, this morning I decided, okay, like, I should at least watch it to see the video and understand. It was exactly as I predicted, a, you know, very hard thing to watch. You know, this young boy, we hear so much about the impacts of bullying at school and amongst young kids, but it's very seldom you can actually put a face on it and put a name on it and see a video like this. So I actually have some of the audio from young Keaton Jones. This is Keaton Jones, 10-year-old boy from Knoxville, Tennessee. He got picked up at lunch after being bullied at school and was clearly in a bit of distress, and his mother is recording this video, so you can hear it now.
Just out of curiosity, why did they bully? What's the point of it? Why do you find joy in taking innocent people and finding a way to be mean to them? Not okay.
What do they say to you?
They make fun of my nose. They call me ugly. They say I have no friends. People that are different don't need to be criticized about it. It's not their fault. But if you are made fun of, just don't let it bother you. Just stay strong, I guess. Hard, but it'll probably get better one day.
So that's pretty obviously tough to listen to. That's difficult to hear when you see the video in the poor boy's face with him crying. I mean, like I said, it's very seldom that you can actually, you know, people know bullying's wrong. People know we need to talk more about bullying in schools. But when you can actually see a video like that, it has such an impact. When you watch that, you just, like, it just rips your heart out.
I think his mom should, you know, do something in front of the school that he goes to and play that video in front of them and see if they still would bully a kid after that. Because something like that is like, there should be no place in school for bullying. And I know kids like to tease and kids like to, but I think that case with Keaton is beyond that, because he mentioned in that video that, you know, just because you're different doesn't mean that you need to be teased for it. I mean, he's already going through whatever he is going through right now, that he doesn't need a kid to point in his direction and laugh at him or whatever the case might be. So to me, I think that video needs to be played in schools to show kids the impact of bullying and what, you know, what causes it, kind of thing.
No, yeah, that's a good point. This would be such a great teaching tool, because that's the thing. When someone's bullied, a lot of time they'll, you know, obviously try to put on a tough face to, you know, not let it show that it bothers them. But then, you know, the other side, when they get home or when they're, you know, spending time alone, you see the impact of it. And, you know, I always think, you know, I've spent some time coaching kids, playing rugby and that sort of stuff. And, you know, one of the hardest messages to get across to kids is, like, you know, the message that we heard when you're younger, that, you know, well, when you're my age or when you're older, you'll think back. And, you know, one thing, you know, most of us have an experience in school at some age where you probably treated someone worse than you should have. You were probably mean to someone at some point in time. You likely engage in some sort of bullying, hopefully not much, but, you know, it's one of those things that happens. Kids, you know, unfortunately, kids will be involved in bullying at some point in time. Not saying you are a bully, but it's just natural. It's just a common thing to sometimes be involved in. I just think of the, you know, the few times that I was involved in that and how it still pains me to think, you know, it's like, oh, like, why did I say that? Like, why did I do that? Why did, you know, and it pains you now. And, but to try to tell it to kids, like, trust me, like, you don't want to be, there's a whole bunch of reasons you shouldn't be bullying kids. But one of those reasons is you're really going to regret, you know, treating anyone like that, especially at that age. And you think back about it later and, you know, I try to get that message across. So it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't always hit, you know, as with kids trying to tell them, you know, well, you know, thinking back, you're really going to regret this. But man, you know, I would, you know, we don't maybe give kids enough credit that, you know, if they see that video, I'm sure that would, you know, certainly change the actions of a lot of kids.
I think if you took them out of the environment of them being in front of their friends and stuff like that, and then you show them that video one-on-one as well, then they might have a different feeling about what they did at that certain time, because then all of a sudden it's just them in a room watching that video, and they can make their own decision on whether or not it was right or wrong. And obviously we know that bullying is not okay, and we need to, you know, teach our kids that this happens and we need to avoid this kind of stuff. But I think that video of Keaton right there, just that's an example that kids need to watch and see, just to show the impact that bullying has on certain people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, one of the good things to come out of it is how, you know, widely this has been shared. We're talking to the tens, 20, beyond millions of times this has been shared. So clearly that, you know, that message is getting out. A lot of, you know, Hollywood star power, Ryan Seacrest, Chris Evans actually invited him to the premiere of the Avengers premiere in LA next year. So that's cool. So Captain America inviting you to come see that Avengers movie. Mark Ruffalo also, you know, inviting him to come out and see that movie. I'm just scrolling down this list of, you know, celebrities who are, you know, helping support young Keaton Jones. It's a long list. A lot of people. See Dr. Phil in there, Dale Earnhardt Jr. You know, it's certainly is a long list. A lot of athletes as well, kind of getting on board and trying to, you know, help show some support, so hopefully things change around. But, you know, so kind of a good ending to a story, and hopefully, you know, things will change for Keaton, and that video will help change things for some kids and draw, you know, a little bit more of a spotlight, and certainly, you know, a spotlight, not just people saying how wrong and how hurtful it is to bully, but really seeing it, you know, that palpable feeling, that gut-wrenching feeling, that maybe a few tears, you know, how real that is when you see it like that.
And the conversation needs to continue, not just stop at the fact that he got invited to Captain America or the Avengers movie and stuff like that. It needs to continue to be something more than just this one incident, because, you know, we might talk about this now, but in a week or so, you know, it's in the back of everyone's mind. So that conversation needs to continue and carry over to make sure that the message is getting across to other people too.
Absolutely. Okay, James, we're going to take a quick break after this. As I mentioned before, something that I discovered while in Florida that is not illegal in Florida it kind of blew my mind, and I'm thinking it might blow your mind as well. We'll be back right after this.
When extreme weather hits, count on the 570 Extreme Weather Center.
We're back with the Jennifer Campbell Show. Jeff Pickle from the 570 Newsroom here, filling in for Jennifer, not feeling well. Taking the day to recoup. Very likely to be back here tomorrow, but for now, very happy to fill in. So I said before the break, something that alarmed me when I was in the Sunshine State of Florida, that this act was not illegal yet in Florida, but is in, it's in the news right now because it might be become laws. James, how many times when you've been producing the show has the topic of texting and driving come up? ballpark.
Probably about five or six times.
Yeah.
At least
in about that number of months as well.
Where we've had OPP on or we've had a lawyer on about texting and driving or something like that. Yeah.
Well, you would be surprised to know that texting and driving is not illegal in the state of Florida.
Seriously?
I'm serious. And I found this out. So I was watching the news. And actually, I got a clip that we'll play. Watching the news, and I heard this. And literally stopped what I was doing, turned around and listened. If we have that clip, we can play it. Yeah, so here's the news clip I heard that kind of made my jaw drop a little bit.
The effort to make texting and driving in Florida a primary offense just got some major support. Think about getting a ticket every time you reach for your phone in the car. Wink News reporter Jessica Alpern is in the Wink News live drive in Fort Myers with that story.
Yeah, Channing. So right now, Florida is only one of four states where you can't get pulled over for texting while driving. So this change, it would have a huge impact on our roadways. Right now, distracted driving is a huge problem in Florida, causing 49,000 crashes last year in which 200 people died. That's one of the reasons lawmakers are so fired up about this. The other, they say our current law from way back in 2013 is behind the times.
Behind the times.
Understatement of the year right there.
Yeah, that law is behind the times. So you had an audible gaffe there, James, when you heard that statistic of 49,000 crashes caused by distracted driving last year in the state of Florida, resulting in 200 deaths.
2,000.
Was it 2,000?
I think that's what it said, yeah.
Regardless.
That's insane. Yeah. Like, to me, like, what are you waiting for? Like, all you have to do is look up here in Canada and see an example of the impact of texting and driving and what the law has done to change that and the fines. Like the fines up here are what, $450 or $500 if you get caught texting and driving, I think.
Yeah. So then that's the other point of it. We didn't quite get to that clip. So that was from Wink News out of Fort Myers. So that's the other part that was crazy about this that I wanted to bring up, and I'm glad you did because I might have forgot about it, was that the fine that they're suggesting for texting and driving on the first offense. So in Canada, $495?
I think that's what
first
the fine
offense,
is, yeah.
Texting and driving?
Yeah.
Just venture a guess what it would be, what they're proposing it to be in Florida.
$250.
Lower.
Lower. You can't tell me that it's not $100
It's a lot lower. $30.
Oh my goodness.
$30.
That's not a hefty enough fine. And they have to use us as an example. I
know.
Think.
Well, I mean, I know. And like, I couldn't. And then $60 on the second offense. So you do it twice, you have a $60 fine, which I'm not even quite sure what, I mean, how that works with our system. If it becomes a higher fine, either way, if you get two offenses of texting and driving in Canada, you're close to $1,000. If you do it there in the United States, you're close to $100 in fines.
So when you were in Florida, did you see a lot of people on their phones while they were driving?
The one weird thing that I noticed, I didn't particularly notice texting and driving. Like, you notice it here a lot, yeah. Anyways, even though we have the compared to this outrageously high fine. What you notice a lot of people doing, because I do believe that talking on your cell phone is illegal. So you can't have your cell phone to your ear. But what you see a lot of people do is just have it on speakerphone and they're just kind of holding it in their hand. And you can tell they're talking on their phone. They're just holding the phone in their hand away from them, which is kind of a weird thing going on. But yeah, I mean, after I heard that, I was already, anytime you're in a foreign country driving, you're a little bit more cautious or a little bit more uneasy. So when I heard this, it was like, definitely when you're pulling up, there was a million four-way stops and it's like every time you pull up there, it was like waiting for that guy to fully stop before I went. I don't know.
Has Florida ever heard of Bluetooth?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and this is why I wanted to bring it up as well, because our zombie law is back in the news.
Right.
It passed its first reading. So in Canada, potentially, so not Canada, in Ontario, this zombie law that could be coming that makes it illegal to be texting when you're crossing a street.
Mm-hmm.
Look up from your phone when you're crossing a street, when there's the possibility of being hit by a car. Look up from your phone so you can, I guess, avoid getting struck. That's, getting closer to becoming a law in Ontario. The fine for that, for doing that, for texting while crossing the street, it will be set around $50.
Right.
So it would cost you more to get caught in Ontario walking and texting than it does in Florida driving and texting.
Yeah, there's something wrong about that. Florida really needs to, I think they really need to up that fine just to start out to at least $100 or $200 for your first offense when it comes to texting and driving.
It's scary to think of that. Like, I didn't know that. And then all of a sudden you're driving. It's like, I really, really wish I was, you know, you could be more careful. But hey, you know what? I mean, I just thought it was humorous in a way that we can look at this is the fact that, yeah, it would cost, if our law is passed in Ontario and the law is passed in Florida, it will cost you more. The ticket is more expensive to get caught walking and texting in Ontario than driving and texting in Florida. And I just think that's a great way to look at
that's ridiculous.
Very similar yet very different legal systems.
Yeah, that's totally, the fine needs to be higher for that.
Yeah. Well, James, thanks for joining me on this one. We do have to take a quick break. When we come back, though, we're going to be talking continuing Jen's series on Spotlight, a spotlight on women around Waterloo Region today. In just a few minutes, just after 9:30, I'll be happy to bring along Dr. Julia Biederman. She's with the Executive Dean of the School of Engineering at Conestoga College. So very happy to talk with Julia, and we'll be talking about her work getting more women, getting more girls involved in the STEM area of education and some of the work that she's done and some of the work that needs to continue. So we'll take a quick break. We'll be back right after that.
You can scroll through your selfies all day.
Let me take a selfie.
Or put some actual news in your news feed. Click on 570news.com or go to your app store and download the 570 News app.
Welcome back to the Jennifer Campbell Show. Jeff Pickle here filling in for Jennifer. And part of a series that Jennifer has been running now for several weeks now, a spotlight on some of the women around Waterloo Region. Today I'm happy to be joined by Dr. Julia Biederman, who is a PhD in civil engineering and is the as a professional engineer, is currently holds the position of Executive Dean for the School of Engineering, Technology, and Trades at Conestoga College. She's dedicated her educational career endeavors to the STEM fields and sits on numerous STEM-related councils, boards locally, provincially, on the national levels. Julia, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. And that was, I said the word STEM, which is something that, we hear a lot more of, but this educational, I guess, stream of things that are STEM. What are we talking about when we're talking about, STEM as far as, in the educational field?
So STEM represents the subjects science, technology, engineering, and math.
Yes. So the stuff that was a little bit lower on my report cards, all of those all those factors, those things, the science, as you said, science. So that's it. Science, technology, engineering, math. Those fields, and a lot of the work you have done in your career has been centered around getting more women, more girls involved in these in the STEM stream of education, and getting more because I'm guessing. Well, I'm not guessing. I know that there's been a lack of women in those fields.
Right. So I started off in engineering a long time ago. I would date myself, but back in 1980 when I went into engineering. And the number of women in engineering back then was pathetic at 10% when I was an undergrad. So it was immediately apparent to me that I was in a minority, and it didn't seem right. So I got involved in activities related to retaining women in engineering as an undergrad, as well as looking at how to get more women into engineering. And that just continued after I graduated and right into my professional career. I've always been involved in activities trying to get more women into engineering, primarily. And then when I joined Conestoga College, and as you said, I'm the Dean of Engineering, Technology, and Trade, so I have the whole group there underneath me, and it's really apparent that we don't have enough women in those fields, and it doesn't make sense to me, having been in those fields and taught in those fields, worked in those fields, doesn't make sense. We need to do more about it.
Yeah. And so you said when you began, you were a 10% of that entire STEM category being women. And where are we at now, you know, down the line? I know there's been a lot of attention, a lot of, you know, promoting of getting more people, more women involved. Where are we at now from that 10% you were at?
So I think the universities have done a really good job in the engineering schools. And they are, we have some universities up as high as 30% engineering, female engineering students in their undergraduate programs. I'd say the average is more around 20 to 25%. So in 30 years, it's doubled. We have a long way to go. Engineers Canada wants to have 30% women by 2030. The bottleneck is the high school courses. If we don't get the girls going into the proper courses in high school, we're never going to reach 50%.
Well, and that's just what I was going to ask. You know, what is the barricade that's there? What's blocking that number from reaching any higher? And so it sounds like it's, you know, something that, you know, when you're deciding what you want to do post-secondary, you know, you've already had to make some decisions based on classes and interests you have.
Yeah, and I don't think it's so much the math and the life sciences. It's probably more physics in terms of engineering. Stopping women from getting into engineering, if only 30% of your grade 12 U-level physics class is female, you've only got 30% of the population to draw from. Even worse than that would be the students going into computer science, which is the technology side, and trades. Just pathetic. It's really sad.
Yeah, I know. And I think that was maybe a conversation we've had before. I've definitely had with Conestoga College some of the work they're doing as far as the trades go. And I know that it's kind of along similar lines, gains being made, but not certainly maybe the numbers that you would like to see. So we're talking about, you know, the main barriers coming when people are early in life, young in life, in high school or even before. What is it that stops, that's preventing more women from getting in the calculus, into physics? Is it a social thing? Do we know why that's like that?
Well, I can't claim to be an expert on it. I've certainly heard a lot. A number of reasons, and there's a lot of outreach. They're not choosing it in the right place, or choosing the right subjects at the right time. Why is that? Is it society? Is it parents? Is it teachers? I mean, there's just so many different factors. And I think as a society, we're doing better. We are encouraging our girls, but it's about not just educating the girls. It's about educating everybody they come in contact with, their parents, their teachers, so that they start to recognize more the opportunities that are out there. So if you take the trades, for example, young women aren't encouraged to go into the trades because probably it's seen as a physical barrier, for one thing, not to mention the climate of the workplace. But physical is probably the worst one. Why do you want to do a dirty job? And that's not necessarily true. So if you think of women in millwright, and a millwright is like a Jill of all trades that fixes all types of different machinery, well, strength is certainly an asset, but it can be overcome with the right tools. And so if you get a woman going into a millwright program, that doesn't necessarily mean that she's not going to be successful because she's not strong. There are other ways around that. And that's what makes the difference, is just knowing, oh, hey, I can do this, instead of somebody saying, oh, you don't want to do that. Why would you want to do that?
Absolutely. I know my brother is an electrician. I know from, you know, what he tells me, you know, he's a smart guy, and he says, you know, 90% or more of the job is, it's, you know, sure, the end product is you're doing something physically with your hands, but it's, you know, it's entirely a mental job figure. You know, it's, again, a lot of principles of math and engineering involved. And you brought up something, and it's just bringing back to me all these other conversations that I've had previous about, you know, the fact that it's not necessarily just a factor of this conversation about, you know, wanting to give more girls and more women the chance to participate in these fields, but it's kind of also a fact that we're going to need them. Like, we've talked about, you know, aging demographics and just huge gaps in, you know, not enough skilled workers. It's not just a deal about opportunity. It's a deal about the fact that we're going to need so many more people. If we're excluding such a large segment of the population, we're going to have a huge shortfall.
Yeah, that's correct. So if you look across the spectrum in Canada, we have of an aging demographic. And so almost every area, every occupation is saying, I'm in trouble. My average work age is increasing, and all of a sudden I'm not going to have enough people. So I need more people, whether I'm a bricklayer, whether I'm an accountant, whether I'm in banking. Everybody is going to need more people. But those that are really in dire straits are things like the trades and engineering and technology, because if they're not getting people from 50% of the population already, they're really in trouble. So we have to get girls going into more STEM-related fields so that we can fill that shortage. We need it as a society, that impending shortage coming up in the next 20 years.
Yeah, no kidding. It's something you do hear a lot about. I know I've heard it myself several times, and you just wonder, you know, what the answer is going to be. You talked about, you know, obviously gains have been made. You talked about, you know, certainly an optimism that a lot more can be made. What are we doing now that's working to help through the STEM field, through the skilled labor field? What's working right now, and what can we kind of do more to do better in the future?
I think the outreach activities that many different groups are doing with young girls, whether they are in elementary school or middle school or high school, really helps to demonstrate to them that they can do it and opens up doors for them. I think we have to do more in terms of educating parents and possibly secondary school teachers about opportunities for young women in these non-traditional areas. If you look at why do we get 50% women going into medicine, those people are really smart. They can just as easily be going into engineering or IT. And a lot of people that go into programs that are, I would say, a little bit lower level, why aren't they going into the trades? Because they just don't know about it. So it's education of all different levels, not just the young girls. But the outreach activities, I got to say, the things that we do at Conestoga College, like our Jill of All Trades Day, is absolutely fantastic for giving the girls an opportunity to do something hands-on, and then they get that confidence in themselves that I can really do it.
Yeah, no, and I've seen that before, and I've seen some of the videos and some of the different testimonials of people who have been involved. It seems to have been a great success. You know, there's one other thing that you brought up that I think is also important to this equation, and I think you would be a perfect person to speak about this, is you talked about also about, you know, once you're through the educational process, then it's a workplace thing, and then entering a male-dominated field. You know, you mentioned the skilled labor field, which I think people would have their own, you know, conception about what that would be like entering one of those fields, which is, you know, seen as a pretty, you know, tough workplace. But also, you know, anytime you're in a minority, when you said you were 10% of women in STEM at the time you got into it, you know, how big of a deterrent is that once you make it through all that education and you go through a field that you're, you know, in a minority, and then to enter a workplace where, you know, obviously might not be the most welcoming, might not be the most hospitable place to be? How big of a deterrent is that?
Well, I guess it depends on the person, and it certainly can be a deterrent, but there's more and more networking happening, and especially with social media, that can really support people. And so when a woman gets into a male-dominated field, she really has to reach out. She has to look for other women if that's what's needed to give that support network. And can the businesses themselves do better? Probably they can. Personally, I've always been in a male-dominated field, and I've never had a problem. But then I always have looked for other women around me in my field and try to search them out and then make those connections so that you've got that social support network.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mentioned I'd done a few stories in the past on, you know, the Fierce Founders program out of Communitech that essentially is that, a network of all female entrepreneurs, founders. And that's the one thing, you know, I've heard over and over again is how important it is, you know, in that startup field that is, you know, again, a fairly male-dominated field, how important it is to network with other women who are doing this and you know, find success through that partnership, those relationships.
Yeah, and so there are great groups of women out there like Girl Geeks, and they support women in the programming field. And so there's a lot more that wasn't there when I was younger of social media presence, and you can connect with other women that do the same thing. So support programs like Fierce Founders, bringing them together. Communitech has some other things that they do to bring young women together.
Yeah, no, it's well, great to talk to you, Julie, about this, because it is an interesting thing. And one of the things I know we just before we got on here that you thought might be important to bring up is that there's been a lot of focus specifically on the engineering field, but then also focusing on the other fields and maybe bringing a little bit more attention to the S, the T, and the M, and not just on the engineering aspect of it. What was your thoughts on focusing on the full STEM group?
Right. So I think what I was saying earlier is that early in my career, I focused on engineering because that's where I came from. And now it's broadened, includes technology and trades. It's really what I've been saying all along, that there's just so much more that we can do to get more women into these fields. And the one other thing that I wanted to mention about it, another reason why I feel so strongly that young women should be going into these fields, it's not only the job opportunities, but it's the ability to make a really good income. So if you're going off into something that's more the social sciences, because that's where you think that's where women find work, you're really missing out on great opportunities to have financially rewarding careers and independence.
Yeah. Okay. No, Julia, thanks so much for joining me. It's a great series that Jennifer has started here. Every Monday, I believe, we do a spotlight on women around Waterloo Region today. So happy to be joined by Dr. Julia Biederman. Julia, yeah, thanks so much. Again, a conversation that I'm happy to have, and I'm happy that we could have someone with your experience come in here and to chat with us about that.
Well, thanks so much for having me on air.
Okay, we're going to go for a quick break. We'll be back right after this.
We crowdsource our traffic. From the bumper-to-bumper crowd surrounding you.
Real-time traffic solutions from sources across the city and you. Your traffic team is 570 News. Kitchener's breaking news, traffic, and weather station.
All right, welcome back to the Jennifer Campbell Show. Jeff Pickle here filling in. Just piecing the show together at the last minute. I'm happy we could, because there was an article that I ran across that just hit me, and it struck me, and I really wanted to kind of hear more about this. So the title itself will probably grab you. In debts, threats, despair, bondsman life in mafia-run gambling dens. So this article by Jeremy Grimaldi talks about these gambling dens, as he says, run in a mafia-style illegal gambling venues through the Woodbridge area, through York Region, in Vaughan. Numerous of these types of places that come up, more than you would think. You know, we're talking in the, around 50 of these type of gambling dens, gambling bars open, all of them illegal. He takes the story of one man and talks about, you know, his lifelong struggle with gambling addiction and a gambling addiction at these illegal venues, and how, you know, the safety concerns that are involved with that, and the man who has been through, you know, threats on his life, and just the, you know, the tribulations that this individual has been through. And, you know, gambling addiction is something that's not, you know, talked about a lot, but certainly has ruined this guy's life. And that part drew me in, and also just kind of the, you know, how widespread, something that I wouldn't know where to go. I wouldn't know where to find. I didn't even know they existed, these illegal gambling dens, but apparently, you know, at least in certain parts of the province, they're to be found everywhere. So as I mentioned, the journalist who wrote this piece, Jeremy Grimaldi. Jeremy, did I get that name right?
Yes, sir, almost. It's Jeremy Grimaldi.
Okay, okay. Apologies, but thanks so much for joining me. This article, very well written, a great piece. You know, as I said, captivated me and drew me in. I tried to do it a little bit of justice there in the preview, but, you know, what's kind of the situation we're looking at in this area of, you know, York Region and the Woodbridge and Vaughan area about these, you know, illegal gambling venues?
Well, in Vaughan, I mean, there's gambling problems in loads of communities, right? A lot of ethnic communities have the bug, and I mean a lot of non-ethnic communities have the bug. But what you see is people not going to the casinos and going to their local bars where they can get access to gambling very easily, and their friends are there, their local social spots. And what they're doing is playing, a lot of them playing on these, they're sort of slot machines, but they're not slot machines. They have buttons on them, and they are illegal. They have different odds than the Ontario-run casinos. And what this guy says happened is at the beginning, you know, it's kind of a classic story. At the beginning, he started seeing some winnings, and slowly but surely those winnings faded away. But he was still hooked, and he was on them all day, every day, outside his working hours, obviously, to the point where he says he lost $4 million in these illegal-run gambling dens over a 30-year period.
Yeah, that was incredible when I read that, the amount of money this individual, you know, had lost, and, you know, what he had been through. And you know, it kind of, as I said, struck me as, you know, something that, you know, certainly I guess a lot of people are probably not familiar with. When we talk about these bars and cafes, I mean, is this like you walk into the bar, then you go to the back, you knock on the door two times, and you get into a separate room? Did he let you in at all, like kind of how these bars are set up and how, you know, people are finding them and that aspect of things?
Yes. And it's a very social network that's involved. So and the way you described it is a bit much, but it's similar.
Yeah.
So you are introduced to the bar owner, and there is a back room, but there's also a front room, and the front room is very straight up. Normal people don't just walk in there and order coffees, but they do serve coffee. And he says in the piece, how they keep you hooked on coffee. You're drinking coffee, free espresso. You can drink it all the time, and that keeps you gambling, obviously. But he said, you know, the image is a bunch of old Italian men playing traditional Italian card games in the front window. But in the back room, there's some serious gambling going on. There's a high stakes poker, as well as these machines. And he says the mob actually brings these machines to the bar and has them there, repairs them when needed, empties them out. And so the bar is not necessarily owning the machines, but they are compelled to have the machines there. And what you said about the fact that this issue is not really talked about is one of the ways why the mob is interested. It's not talked about. It's not discussed. And the gamblers don't talk about it themselves, right? They do it all undercover. They do it behind closed doors.
Yeah.
It's sort of a, you know, one guy in the story describes it as a victimless crime because the gambler's going back himself over and over and over again.
Well, and you bring up, you say victimless crime, and you bring up crime, the amount of, you know, some of these places that are, I guess, known to be gambling dens, places you can get your coffee and gelato, and then, you know, there's gambling in the back, have been, mm-hmm. you know, well noted, certainly in recent months and years, to have been places where, you know, very targeted violence has happened, certainly, you know, hit-style, you know, killings have taken place.
Yeah, and it, somehow it sort of flew under the radar. We had a double murder in 2015. Four people were shot, two people killed, and it was an illegal gambling den. We had a high-stakes poker player killed just this year. And that was, there were seven murders in Vaughan in a couple months. And we've also had places blown up. We've had firebombings. We've had a restaurant shot at. Where bullets are going through the window, there's patrons here, and somehow it hasn't registered that it may be down to gambling, gambling territory.
Right.
And so, you know, it's interesting.
You know, it certainly is. And Jeremy, sorry, I squeezed this in. I wish we had more time to talk about it. We just have about a minute left. But the other big part of this is that, you know, this individual did go to police, but the response, I guess, hasn't been kind of up to what he thought it may have been. Can you maybe just briefly run down, you know, the law enforcement aspect of this and what's happened on that side?
Sure. I mean, and you know, as you know, historically, people may see it as a sort of a problem that doesn't get dealt with by police. You know, you could say it's bad guys killing bad guys, and we'll just let it go. That's a very cynical view, and I don't necessarily believe that, but that's what a lot of people think. And in this situation, that's the way he feels. So he went to police, and he says that they treated him sort of like a loser, a compulsive gambler, degenerate gambler who doesn't deserve help or, you know, got himself into this mess. And they're not seeing the wider picture that the public are now at risk. This isn't just something affecting, gamblers, but the public are all around these shootings, and their lives are at risk.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It is, as I said, a fascinating piece. And, I don't think we had the full amount of time to get into this. It's a great written piece. If you have time today, by all means, it's at York Region, the paper Jeremy writes for, a great piece. If you have time, check it out. Jeremy, yeah, thanks so much.
YorkRegion.com.
Yes, YorkRegion.com. thanks so much for joining me. Unfortunately, we do have to go. We're going to go to a news break, and we'll be back with the Mike Farwell Show right after this.